This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 18th of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, we'll be analysing another day of violence in Paris as dawn raids leave two suspects from the weekend's terror attacks dead and seven more in custody. My guests Raffaello Pantucci and Sebastian Borger will be assessing what we know so far, among the day's other stories, including...
When individuals say that we should have a religious test and that only Christians, proven Christians, should be admitted. That's offensive and contrary to American values. I cannot think of a more potent recruitment tool for ISIL than some of the rhetoric that's been coming out of here during the course of this debate.
With the Western world on a high terror alert, the US is now using the refugee crisis as a political football. Well, some politicians there anyway. We'll be finding out why. We'll also be looking at France's military actions in Syria and questioning whether it's hitting any of the right targets in the fog of war. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute. Sebastian and Raffaello, thank you both for joining us today. We start with the latest from Paris and what we know so far. In the early hours of this morning, French police staged a raid on a flat in the neighbourhood of Saint-Denis as part of the manhunt for the suspected planner behind last weekend's horrific terrorist attacks in the city. A woman at the property detonated a suicide bomb, killing herself. Another unnamed man was killed in the ensuing violence. Seven arrests have been made. Raffaello Pantucci, was this a sort of a moment where the French security forces, in a sense, sort of reasserted their control over this story and took some action that many people in Paris were hoping they were going to be able to take?
Well, I think clearly, you know, the French security forces would have been primed to have this sort of an aggressive response to this kind of a situation. If they look at what they knew that this cell was capable of, which is what we saw happen in Paris on Friday last week, which was to die in the conduct of their action while butchering as many people as they could, you know, the only real response you can have is a very hard kinetic one. So I think that we're clearly seeing that they would have expected this sort of a response. I think the one thing which is interesting to me is to think back to the Madrid bombings of 2004, where you might remember that the cell had actually sort of, they'd left the bombs on the trains and then they were planning a second wave, which didn't actually work. But when they were cornered in their building, they also went down fighting, you know, and blew themselves up rather than get sort of captured. So I think French security forces would have known that this was going to be the case. And I think, in fact, if we look back at all the arrests we've seen over the past few days, they've been very sort of aggressive in what they're doing. And you can see from all the footage that's emerging that they're using weapons in every case and they're really putting themselves on a forward posture, which is as much about worrying about the threat as it is about sort of comforting the public to show that we are able to do this.
Sebastian, there have been a number of incidents from one of the attackers paying for a room with his own credit card to one of the people throwing away their mobile phone, which was found in a bin nearby before he carried out the attack, to this woman who blew herself up making a phone call beforehand, that make you think either they didn't care what happened next because they expected to be dead, or they were actually not that professional.
Couldn't both be true? Isn't that the nature of the beast, that there are a number of dilettantes on both sides, although I would suggest that there are rather more dilettantes on the terrorist side? And also, of course, that if you come towards the end of your life for whatever reason, in this case your very own rather warped reasons, you lose a certain amount of caution. That seems to be the case. Your question to Raffaello, of course, implied that the French had lost control, which I have to say I can't see. You know, there's been mistakes. They let someone go at the border, which was rather unfortunate. But that happens in an open society, in a democracy.
Do you think, on the whole, since the attack itself, the French police have actually dealt with this pretty well?
Even during the attack, you know.
I mean, since the attack, as in sort of ignoring what happened before and things that could have been done to prevent it.
Yes, I mean, when you look at the history of, I haven't studied the French history of terror attacks very carefully. I know a little bit about the British of the last sort of 10 years. In almost every case, we now know that the security services in Britain knew names, had actually followed certain people, people were on their watch lists, etc. And people fell off their watch lists again for whatever reason. And I think quite rightly, very few people seem to blame the security services for that, because that's just the nature of the beast. You can't keep hold of all of these people all the time.
Well, I think the key is that we don't know the entire intelligence picture that's being looked at. And so while we may focus on these individuals and say, well, they knew them and how could they let them pass and go, the reality is that we don't know how many other people they were looking at who seemed, because of their activity, to be priorities.
They talk about 10,000.
They talk about 10,000, exactly.
The Brits talk about 3,000, for example.
Or four.
You know, that's over 3 to 4. Mm. That's a different dimension again.
And, you know, if you're going to watch a person for 24 hours a day, it requires almost 30 people to do that. It's a very labor-intensive thing. So you do it very selectively. So you do it on people you're prioritizing. If we think back to the Charlie Hebdo guys from earlier this year, you know, the two Kouachi brothers had been of concern for some time. They'd been to Yemen. They'd clearly received training and met Awlaki. You know, so these were people who are of concern. But for a good 6 months, they hadn't really done much. You know, and so from the security service perspective, they watch these guys and they're like, well, are we wasting our time here? You know, we don't know that these guys are really going to go do something. We'd rather prioritize the individuals who, I don't know, we notice are, you know, expressing a lot of interest in trying to build a bomb or maybe fraternizing with someone we know has access to weapons. And so we'll prioritize them as people of attention rather than these guys who are just, you know, sitting around at home and going to the shops and being sort of average citizens. The difficulty in sort of second guessing these sorts of things is that we just don't know the sort of whole picture. I would argue, having said all of that, within this case, you know, the numbers of people we see involved in this network and the sorts of attack that was able to be conducted suggest that something did slip through. But at the same time, you know, it's still it's a very difficult sort of thing to look at and say, well, you know, what did they miss and how could they have known these people and not have known what they were going to do?
And there's an argument that if you've had a fawning feature published in Dabiq, yeah, that, you know, explaining about how you want to bring terror to the heart of Europe, then you should perhaps be someone that, you know, an eye should be kept on.
But that's the key person. And we know that he was in Syria at the time. And in Syria, that means he's out of their control, right? So that's someone that they know is abroad. The question is more the network of people who conducted the attack on the ground. And that's what we don't know about. And this question of whether Abaoud is in France at the moment, I'm not sure that we've seen the tangible evidence that this is the case yet. There's stories that are circulating that he's gotten back in some way, shape or form, which is possible. But I don't know that we can definitively say that he'd managed to sneak in. The other point, I think, for the French with this particular context is that, you know, whatever the French do within their jurisdiction, they're always going to be a bit hostage to the neighboring jurisdictions that they have. And they've got open borders with those places, which is the beauty of Schengen. And, you know, this is the unfortunate other side of it. If you look at the Belgian authorities or the Swiss or the Spanish, you know, they've got different jurisdictions, different capabilities and different approaches. And unfortunately for the French, you know, they've got a situation where they can do a lot in their territory, but in neighboring territories, well, that's someone else's.
Sebastian, there has inevitably been conversations, not just in the UK, but in the US. John Brennan was talking about this as well, about the powers that security services should be able to have. You know, here there's a discussion about the collection of bulk data in the US as well. There's that sort of conversation as well. And yet, from what you're both saying here, is that actually, you know, the bigger issue might be simply one of manpower rather than, you know, can we collect more data about more people?
I thought that was very interesting that David Cameron, who seems to me to not have put a foot wrong since since it happened, came out on, I think, Monday or Tuesday saying we will give the security services 1,900 more people. Mm. I spoke to a former GCHQ guy about that, who of course then pointed out that this is very nice, and but it'll take a number of years for these people to become operational. You know, if you even if you have the best graduates, they will need 9 to 12 months to function in any sense of the word for the services. But yes, I think that seems to me to be more of the problem, that they are dealing with a great vast amount of data and need people to analyze that data.
Raffaello, I hesitate to make any sort of references to the Second World War, because on the whole, not very useful. But in terms of intelligence, there was a drive during the Second World War, in the UK, for example, with Bletchley Park and the attempts to crack the Enigma machine. Do Western societies need that sort of giant leap now to say, look, we are taking on this, this new monster, and we need to have, the personnel and the capabilities to do it?
Well, I think clearly there does need to be some sort of a growth. And I think what's interesting to me is that actually, if you go back and look at Andrew Parker, the head of of Thames House of the security service here, MI5, if you look, the last speech he gave, he did ask for resources. But the one before that, which was sometime in 2013, if I remember correctly, or 2014, very early 2014, he doesn't refer to needing more resources. And it seems to be a very recent thing that they're really worrying about the amount of resources that they have and the amount that they need. But what I would draw from that is this idea that I think we are still dealing with a threat that is manageable, and I think that we need to be a bit careful to not get too carried away and run in the direction of saying, well, we need to mobilize, everyone, and we need to have huge, secret armies of people who are hunting us. Because at the end of the day, you are still dealing with a relatively limited threat. Even if you look at the maximalist numbers of people who've gone to fight in Syria and Iraq, you're talking about a few thousand Europeans, of whom we don't know that all of them are as dedicated to these individuals we saw in Paris the other day.
Some might have gone, oh my God, this is terrible, I'm going home.
Some might have gone, had a bad experience. Some might have gone to fight with Jabhat al-Nusra. Some are dead. Exactly. So, and some are just these international warriors who want to keep fighting. And so they get bored in Syria. They go on to Afghanistan. They go on, it just goes on. So I think we need to be a little bit careful to not go too overboard. And I think that's in some ways one of the big concerns I'd have in the sort of response to Paris. And one of the issues that has really bothered me around this question of the Syrian passport that may or may not be linked to the individuals is that, the danger is that we start to have a conversation which says, well, it's this immigrant problem, and if only we could close our borders in some sort of way, that would somehow defend us. The majority of these guys, it's going to turn out, had deep roots into Europe. These were European citizens,
And also, I'm very uncomfortable with all the talk about war. I just think, come on, guys.
It feeds their narrative. Narrative is there's a clash of civilizations. If we start doing it, then...
We are in command here, and we've got good police forces to deal with the problem of criminal mass murder. Mm-hmm. And let's not talk about war.
Yeah. We're going to come on to that issue in a moment. But first of all, I want to actually touch on the impact this has had on how politicians have dealt with the refugee crisis. As we heard at the beginning of the program, Barack Obama has described comments made by his Republican counterparts about the prospect of Syrian refugees entering the US as offensive and hysterical. He was reacting to 15 state governors, most of them Republican, but there was one Democrat, saying they will not accept refugees from Syria, including one, Chris Christie, who said that he wouldn't even accept orphans under the age of 5. Sebastian Borger, I don't really even know where to begin with that, the idea that you're scared of a three-year-old orphan. But there we are. How can this sort of fear-mongering be dealt with?
only by other politicians, as the president in this case did, challenging them about it, and also the public saying, "Come on, guys, let's keep some perspective." What we just said about this talk of war, the same thing, of course, is these people seriously talking about we only want to let in Christians. I mean. Are we really back to that? I mean, it used to be white people and then of whatever faith or none, and now it's only Christians who I don't know, what do they have to do to prove they're Christians? Do they have to recite the Ten Commandments or half the Bible or whatever? I mean, the problem, of course, may be that that some of these people react to real fears and see in their focus groups that the population is that deeply worried. We know that the Americans have a problem with explaining foreign policy to their population.
Raffaello, what can be done to sort of change this narrative? Is it just something that, you know, that is going to happen in the aftermath of an incident like this, but might over time reduce its impact?
I mean, I think it's, you know, you're talking about political environments here and political people who will take advantage of them to advance their own causes. And I think that's the depressing reality. I think in the United States, these stories we've seen of these governors saying these sorts of horrible things, they're just, you know, I don't see who they're helping. And they're clearly just speaking to a domestic constituency. And the problem is that they don't see a consequence in doing that, you know, and frankly, they're lucky in a way that they don't, you know, they're lucky that they don't see that consequence. But it is a sad reality of a sort of free, open society where politicians will try to advance their narratives and try to win votes in whatever way that they can.
And what's striking, I guess, Sebastian, is that this also feeds ISIS's narrative.
Exactly.
And you know, they're the ones that also don't want refugees to be leaving Syria, because that also highlights the fact that their great caliphate is this tremendous lie.
We come back to the same point over and over again. Let's keep some perspective. If you say we only let in Christians, if you say we're at war with ISIL, if you say, like the German Home Secretary after the football match was abandoned last night, that he can't tell people why, because part of the answer would disturb them. And you think, for heaven's sake, I mean, what kind of communication is that? Keep perspective. Yeah. Talk to people about what the problem is. Say that we live in open societies. We want to live in open societies. And there are certain risks. But also be clear about what you can do to prevent terrorism. And I have to say it again. For once, I think David Cameron has acted responsibly and clearly and is communicating a la Tony Blair after 2005.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily the best example.
That's a compliment. That's a compliment.
No.
Yes.
It's a response to the 7/7 attack.
Well, no, because the 7/7 attacks.
But Tony Blair, after 2005, also said the rules of the game have changed. Here are the 10 ways we have to change our way of life. It was a very much, you know, following in George W. Bush's footsteps there.
Okay, so that was the war talk. Then you think, okay, good, I'll take it back.
I want to...
Cameron good, Blair bad.
Well, no, not necessarily on all things. Anyway, let's not even get into Tony
we'll be here all night.
But, okay, look, on this issue of politicians dealing with, we've highlighted some bad things. We've highlighted, as Sebastian said, how he thinks David Cameron has done well. You know, Barack Obama has spoken from the heart and spoken well. Angela Merkel has spoken very well on this, saying we can't blame refugees. And actually, for all your criticism of Francois Hollande and his talk of war, he has also said in the last couple of days, we are going to continue to take refugees from Syria. We can't let, you know, we can't put all the blame on them or any of the blame on them. Why do you think that it's been difficult for some politicians to say those sorts of things, whereas these ones seem to have been okay?
Well, I mean, the people you've all mentioned are kind of father figures of the nation, you know, and this is in a moment of crisis, every leader becomes the kind of, you know, the paterfamilias, right? Or the materfamilias in Angela Merkel's case. You know, and so the mother will always sort of act these reassuring things and say these sorts of confident things because they're in that kind of position. I would look more to things that people like Marine Le Pen or Nigel Farage here in the UK have been saying, which have been very, you know, well-phrased sort of turn, you know, speeches really pointing at some of the issues here. And they no longer really need to sort of, you know, offer the rivers of blood analogies and all these sorts of things because they just say, look at current events. You know, I don't need to say anything else. Just look at current events and look where they're pointing you. And that sort of a narrative is one that actually really resonates, you know. And if you look at the media here in the UK, I mean, you look at the Daily Mail, the most read sort of daily in this nation, you know, it's kind of hinting in this direction as well. And so in some ways, I'm less concerned about the sort of heads of state, because heads of state, that's their role. At that moment, they sort of shed their political biases in many ways and just become the person who is leading the country in this moment of crisis. What I worry about is those other individuals, these sorts of senior political figures who can say, can look at these sorts of contexts and say, well, look, I've been telling you that these people are a problem. And lo and behold, here is the aberration of what I've been telling you all these years.
I want to move on to something that we've slightly touched on already, and that's the talk of war and what France in particular is doing now. They've carried out bombing campaigns inside Syria, in Raqqa. Those continue today. But there is a question, Sebastian Borger, isn't there, aside from whether it's right or wrong, but as to what they're actually bombing? Because, as has been pointed out by others today, including a piece in the New York Times, if these were all legitimate targets in Syria, then surely the Americans would have bombed them already. What is it that they're actually doing?
But that's the same question that we had in the Kosovo campaign in 1999. I mean, there were targets in all over Serbia, which were bombed again and again and again. What you do partly, I think, from a military point of view, is you show resolve. You want to disperse. You want to make people uneasy about their movements. You want to show them that you have superiority of the air, thereby presumably assisting the armies on the ground, with which I presume France are cooperating as much as anybody else. It looks a little bit piecemeal, I suppose, from the distance, but I wouldn't want to second guess military planners, who seem now at least to coordinate their attacks a little more carefully, with particularly the Russians, who were rather rogue, have been rather rogue until a few days ago.
Raffaello, are you convinced that these airstrikes serve any purpose other than to make people in France feel a bit better?
Well, I mean, I think Sebastian's right. It's difficult to know for sure, frankly, what they're actually hitting. I would suspect that, you know, ISIS is probably quite a dynamic and mobile group. So, you know, they'll keep moving around. So I think it's a bit unfair to say, well, wouldn't the Americans have already hit this if this was something to hit? You know, it was possible it wasn't something to hit yesterday, but today it is. And so they're sort of striking in that way. I think what's interesting in some ways, more from the French perspective, is if you look pre-Paris, Yves Le Drian, the defense minister, had said that the strikes that they have been doing have been specifically because of plots that they were worried about that were emanating and threats that were coming back to France. I wonder if they've now broadened out what they're willing to sort of strike, whereas previously they may have been targeting more specifically, you know, I don't know, French camps or camps of people that they were particularly worried about. It's possible now that they're trying to just hit ISIS infrastructure more generally. The difficulty is, in many ways, that, you know, this kind of is a bigger strategic question, which is that if you're going to do these airstrikes, is that what's going to get rid of the group? And it's not totally clear that it is. I think it's going to damage the group and it's going to cause some difficulties, but it's not really going to be the sort of decisive factor.
Now, isn't the main thing that this week, that happened this week, the Vienna conference and the seemingly progress being made on the diplomatic front? Because, again, as every general or air marshal will tell you, we can bomb however long we like. In the end, we need to have a political solution.
But is that progress, you know, likely to be? That can go in two directions. It can go in the direction of, you know, persuading Russia that, look, we need to get rid of Assad, we need a political solution in Syria. Or it can go in the other direction of, okay, look, we don't like Assad, but we can all agree that we need to unite to fight ISIS. Those are two very different directions that we can go in.
And I would suggest that we are now at the stage where we will have to bite the bullet. Sorry, that's a terrible phrase. Where we have to bite into the lemon is maybe better, and accept that Assad. We won't have a solution unless Assad is in some way part of the solution. If only for an interim period,
rather than the Assad in particular. But there is a key difference,
which is a compromise there, which you could see there being an agreement.
Exactly, that's the point. I think that if you look at what the rebels have been saying, the one thing they're all very firm about is Assad must go. Mm-hmm. You know, they're very, very clear about that. Mm-hmm. And you look at every resolution and all these sorts of discussions that you see with all the various rebel factions, be it from the Islamists all the way through to the more secularists, and they all quite categorically will say he must go. And, you know, in many ways, if you look at the problems that we're seeing there, it is something that he has helped stir up.
Well, indeed. And it is also, quite aside from, you know, what blame that he has, Sebastian, there's also the other issue that if the West suddenly turns around and says, OK, we're fine with Assad, what does that do for, you know, for broader Sunni support for ISIS?
I didn't quite mean it like that.
No, I know.
I clearly expressed myself imprecisely, and Raffaello is quite right about talking about the regime rather than the person. And again, I think we're talking about a staged process where he will have to go. I totally agree. The question is in what way and in what time frame. Yeah. And I think we are now talking about those kind of things a little more openly than we did a week ago.
Raffaella, what direction do you think this is going in? Because we've heard, you know, John Kerry, the US Secretary of State, saying we are, you know, possibly weeks away from some sort of an agreement. Are you as optimistic as he is?
No, quite frankly. Because even if we look at the Vienna Agreement, and I agree, there was progress that was clearly made there, but the groups that weren't represented there are some of the ones that represent the largest armed forces on the ground. And quite frankly, I don't know how you can expect a peace accord that doesn't include the people who hold the most guns and the most territory on the ground. So until we found a way of figuring out how we're going to deal with them or how we're going to engage with them or get the others to fight against them in some sort of a more coherent way, I don't know that you're going to be seeing something emerging which is really going to make me feel like we're seeing the end of this road.
Finally, I just want to talk about two football matches from last night, which is unusual for us to talk about this on Monocle 24, but unusual times. One match which went ahead, one match which didn't. Sebastian, you were at Wembley for England versus France. This sort of, you know, football, you know, is incredibly self-important. And yet there is something to be said for how it dealt with this moment last night.
It was really rather moving. And I mean, I talked to my sons, 14 and 17-year-olds, year-old beforehand, and asked, well, shall we go or shall we leave it? And they looked at me as if I was mad, which I thought really summed up the everything we like, maybe even love about London and Londoners. You know, they've got a certain... how shall I put it? You could almost call it a certain unwillingness to engage. But you could also call it just let's get on with it. Let's not be cowed by these people. And they've clearly taken up that spirit and inspired their German father. And so we went and you know, it was very moving. And people did try to sing the Marseillaise, and it went wrong for some people, given that the words are very difficult and also the don't fit the music terribly well. But that's my musical criticism. But yeah, great occasion, great sentiment in the stadium.
But Raffaello, there was supposed to be another match last night in Hanover, which was called off after a bomb scare. And it's, you know, Sebastian referred to us a little bit earlier with what the Home Affairs Minister said or frankly wasn't prepared to say.
Yeah.
Is this just the jittery days after an attack, or is there something more worrying about what this might be like in the weeks and months to come?
Well, I think I think it is the jittery reaction to an attack, quite frankly. But, you know, the stories that are circulating suggest that it's possible French intelligence had picked up something in their investigations that led them to a lead which goes to Hanover. And in this kind of an environment, having just seen this sort of an attack, security services' tendency is to overreact rather than underreact, because the concern is that you're seeing something which you didn't quite know about. So I think that it's understandable, but I think that it is also an immediate reaction to a immediate threat.
We'll have to leave it there. Raffaello Pantucci and Sebastian Borger, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Clara Strunk. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Carlotta Ribello will be here next. Then it's The Entrepreneurs with Danny Giacopelli at 1900. We're back the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.